Usually when you get on a public bus, there is this this kind of universal transit code.
Oh, absolutely. Headphones in.
Right. Headphones in, you actively avoid eye contact, and you just quietly wait for your stop to arrive.
Keep that personal bubble perfectly intact.
Exactly. Unspoken social contracts. But I mean, imagine you are sitting in the very back of a bus in Israel, and the guy sitting next to you isn't just a commuter. He's a renowned Jewish rabbi.
And we are talking about like the kind of religious scholar CNN brings in as an expert, a man literally scheduled to meet the Pope later that week.
Yeah, a heavy hitter. And instead of making polite small talk about the weather or whatever, you decide to ask him the absolute most controversial line-crossing question possible about his faith and yours.
It is the absolute definition of blowing past the small talk.
Seriously.
Yeah.
So Pastor Kent asked him this blaringly blunt question. He said, "Why don't you believe Jesus was God and died for people's sin?"
Wow, just right out of the gate.
Right out of the gate. And the rabbi's response was just as blunt. He looked at Kent and said, "Because God doesn't die."
I mean, that is an absolute conversation stopper.
Total mic drop. But, for us at Harmony Christian Church, Pastor Kent used that exact friction to kick off a deeply uncomfortable but really vital question for our Connect groups this week.
Right, the question of why do we actually believe this stuff?
Exactly. So the mission for today's deep dive is to unpack Kent's latest sermon. We're looking at how he tackled the incarnation, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus, and how he framed it all as the what he called the elegant solution to humanity's ultimate problem.
And we are skipping the surface level Sunday school stuff
Oh,
today.
for sure. We
Ah.
want to make sure you are fully armed with the profound, really challenging insights so you're prepped for your Connect group discussions.
What is so fascinating to me about starting with that rabbi on the bus is the sheer uncomfortable logic of his answer. I mean, God doesn't die. Kent brings that skepticism right to the pulpit because it forces you to confront the absurdity of the core Christian claim.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second, because it is incredibly easy for us churchgoers to just nod along on an Easter or Christmas Sunday.
Oh, yeah. Give me the ham. Give me the deviled eggs.
Yes, we want the food, we want the nice songs, and we just accept the story because it's tradition. But if we actually pause, I mean, if we really think about it, a dying God is a wild, almost offensive
It
concept
really is.
and an all-or-nothing wager.
Yeah.
If dead people stay dead, which in our everyday human experience, they absolutely do, then believing this makes us fools. We're basically basing our entire worldview on a biological impossibility.
And what's fascinating here is that Christians have recognized how absurd this sounds since the very first century. It's not a new critique.
No, not at all.
Kent pointed out that the Apostle Paul, writing around AD 55 in 1 Corinthians, he didn't shy away from this at all. Paul explicitly stated that if the resurrection is a made-up story, Christians are most to be pitied. Yeah, he was acknowledging that followers of Jesus were throwing away their social standing, their safety, and literally their lives for a crucified carpenter.
Paul is basically saying, "Hey, if this is a lie, we're the biggest idiots on the planet. Don't respect us, pity us."
Exactly. Kent uses that rabbi's skepticism to challenge you to move past inherited faith. You know, people who believe just because their parents did.
Or because it's just culturally comfortable.
Right. Kent is demanding that you evaluate the structural foundation of why you actually believe an immortal God suffered a mortal death.
And to really force that evaluation, Kent took this huge shift from, high-level theological debates on a bus to something deeply, painfully personal.
Yeah, that middle school story.
Man, that was rough. He shared this raw confession from his middle school years. He talked about being an overweight kid who was mercilessly bullied.
Right.
But instead of just taking it quietly, he developed a survival mechanism. He used his quick humor to deflect the attention off himself and onto someone else.
Specifically onto a classmate who is mentally handicapped.
Yeah. Kent actually admitted to making up cruel songs to the tune of the Toys R Us jingle,
Yeah.
getting the whole class laughing at this innocent kid's expense.
Hearing a pastor confess something that vividly cruel from their own past, I mean, it creates this heavy silence in the
You
room.
could hear a pin drop.
It perfectly sets up the profound human problem. We all inherently desire a God who is loving and forgiving, especially when we are the ones messing up.
Oh, absolutely. When I mess up, I want grace.
Right. When Kent is the one doing the bullying, or when you or I tell a lie or hurt someone, we want a God who just opens the door and says, "Hey, come on in. All is forgiven."
But see, I struggle with this tension all the time. Think of a human courtroom. Okay? If a judge is sitting on the bench and a criminal who is undeniably guilty of ruining someone's life is standing there, and the judge just waves his hand and says, you know what? I'm a loving judge. I forgive you. Go free.
People would riot.
We would be outraged. We wouldn't call that love. We would call that a tragic, horrific denial of justice for the victim. So how can God simply forgive Kent without looking at that handicapped child crying into his pillow at night and essentially saying, your pain does not matter to the universe?
That tension right there is exactly what Kent defines as the problem of humanity, or what the scriptures call sin, which literally means to miss the mark.
Right.
Real love cannot just turn a blind eye to evil. It has to deal with it. If God is perfectly loving, he must be perfectly just. And if he is perfectly just, he has to punish the evil you and I commit.
It creates an impossible dilemma. If God judges perfectly, well, we are all doomed because we all miss the mark.
Right.
But if he forgives entirely without penalty, he ceases to be just, and the victims of the world are just abandoned.
Which is exactly what necessitates the elegant solution. But, you know, before humanity arrived at that elegant solution, ancient cultures tried to solve the problem of justice and sin in ways that were incredibly visceral.
Oh, the bloody altars.
Yeah. Kent walked through the Old Testament sacrificial system to illustrate this.
He completely ruined the nursery rhyme. Mary had a little lamb for me, by the way.
Oh, forever.
He described this terrifying imagery where people would literally bring their innocent little lambs to the altar, slit their throats, and drain the blood. He said the altar would smell like a 247 slaughterhouse and barbecue.
Which is such a graphic image.
And there was this strict rule in Leviticus 17:11 against consuming the blood.
And Kent drew a really fascinating line here between ancient texts and modern science. God states in Leviticus that the life of a creature is in the blood.
Yeah.
This was declared thousands of years before human beings had microscopes, long before we understood red blood cells carrying oxygen or white blood cells fighting infection. The text identified blood as the literal carrier of life.
So the mechanics of a sacrifice wasn't just like barbaric theater. God says he gave this blood to make atonement.
Right.
And atonement means to cover up, to repair, or to ransom. The animal's life, which was contained in its blood, was poured out to cover the human sin.
The book of Hebrews explicitly states that without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin, but an animal cannot perfectly substitute for a human. It was only a temporary stopgap.
Which means you mess up again, and guess what? You are back to the altar with another lamb.
Exhausting.
Honestly, if God is all-powerful, why go through this bloody repetitive system? Why not just hit the cosmic reset button? Or, you know, better yet, just hand out a permanent list of rules for everyone to follow and enforce them strictly.
Well, Kent unpacked those exact alternatives to demonstrate why they fail. God actually did try the reset button with Noah's flood.
It is like trying to fix a corrupted hard drive by just turning the computer off and on again.
That's a great way to put it.
The hardware restarts, sure, but the virus is still baked into the operating system. Within a generation after the flood, humanity was right back to their wicked ways. You can't just wipe out the problem if the problem is deeply ingrained in the human condition.
And the rulebook alternative fails for a similar reason. God gave the law, but humans are natural rule breakers.
Oh, yeah. Kent joked about himself being a natural rule breaker.
Which complicates his life as a pastor. But it's true. If you give a human a boundary, their immediate psychological instinct is to test it, bend it, or find a loophole around it.
Every single time.
So a reset button leaves you with the same corrupt humanity, and rules only serve to prove how utterly incapable we are of following them.
Wiping us out doesn't work, micromanaging us doesn't work, and sacrificing animals only works temporarily. Humanity is just completely stuck.
Stalled out.
But here's where it gets incredibly profound. Kent introduces the incarnation God, placing all of his divine nature into a human body as the ultimate elegant fix. Jesus enters the very system God designed. He's both fully human and fully God.
And crucially, he lives a flawless life within that corrupted system. He faces the exact same temptations you face.
Yeah, Kent mentioned those everyday urges, right?
Yeah.
The temptation to steal a little from the cash register, to cheat on your taxes, to lie just to save.
Jesus faced all those human pressures but never gave in. Instead, he heals lepers, touching people who hadn't felt physical contact in years. And he directly confronts the corrupt religious elite.
Doing that puts a massive target on his back. And Kent did not hold back in describing the fallout of that confrontation. He clearly wanted to shatter our sanitized childhood views of the cross.
The medical and historical realities of the Passion are horrifying when you actually study them. K Kent started in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus was experiencing such immense anxious stress about what was coming that the blood vessels in his sweat glands literally ruptured.
Hematidrosis.
Yes, hematidrosis is the medical term. He sweats actual drops of blood.
Just from the stress.
Yeah.
And then comes the arrest, the trial, and the Roman cat of nine tails.
Brutal.
This wasn't the standard whip. It was woven with pieces of metal, glass, and jagged bone, specifically designed to hook into the skin and tear the muscle off the body.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah. They gave him 39 lashes, taking him to the absolute brink of death without quite killing him. And then the mechanics of crucifixion itself. I have to admit, I hadn't fully grasped the horror of asphyxiation until Kent explained it.
It changes how you see it completely.
You see paintings where Jesus' knees are bent. That wasn't a stylistic choice by artists. That was the Roman engineering of execution. It wasn't the nails that killed you.
No, it was suffocation.
Exactly. When your arms are stretched out and bearing your weight, your chest cavity is pulled open. You can breathe in, but you cannot physically exhale unless you push your entire body weight up on those pierced feet. Every single breath is an agonizing conscious decision to induce blinding pain just to get air out of your lungs.
Most victims lasted for days in that torturous state. Jesus had been so brutally scourged beforehand that he only lasted a few hours.
Wow.
The physical brutality was a staggering display of cruelty. But Kent pointed out that the physical pain isn't actually the core theological breakthrough of the cross.
I mean, I struggle to understand what could be worse than the physical torture.
It is what happens spiritually in that darkness. On the cross, Jesus quotes Psalm 22, crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? This is the crux of the elegant solution. Jesus wasn't just dying a physical death. The scripture states, he became sin.
Right.
That means in that moment, Jesus was literally experiencing Kent's exact, dark, cruel actions against that handicapped kid.
Wait, hold on. How does that actually work mechanically? Does God just pretend Jesus is a middle school bully? Because that feels like a legal loophole or, I don't know, a cosmic accounting trick.
It is not a fiction or a pretense. In Christian theology, it is an actual ontological transfer. The perfect life and blood of Jesus becomes the substitute. He absorbs the full, unmitigated wrath of God's justice against that bullying, against every lie, against every cruelty you have ever committed.
So he takes the penalty upon himself so that justice is completely satisfied.
Exactly. The innocent boy crying in his pillow gets justice because the evil done to him is punished.
And love is simultaneously demonstrated because God himself stepped in to take that punishment for us. His perfect, sinless blood became the permanent atonement, permanently repairing the gap that the animal sacrifices could never fix.
It perfectly satisfies both the demand for justice and the desire for love.
But, you know, this entire elegant solution falls apart if Jesus stayed in the tomb.
Absolutely.
If dead people stay dead, we are back to being the fools Paul talked about. So for our Connect groups, we really need to know how to defend this. When someone in our lives inevitably claims the resurrection is just a myth or a legend that grew over time or a fabricated conspiracy, what is the actual historical evidence we can point to?
Kent laid out four very specific historical proofs to demonstrate the resurrection wasn't a fabricated narrative. The first proof revolves around the primary witnesses. The very first people to discover the empty tomb and see the resurrected Jesus were women.
Okay, so why does that matter so much as historical proof?
Because in a first century patriarchal culture, women were not considered credible legal witnesses. Yeah, according to historians like Josephus and Talmudic law, a woman's testimony was often completely inadmissible in court. If you are a group of men fabricating a hoax to start a new religion and win over Jewish and Roman men, you would never write women as your primary foundational witnesses.
It actively hurts your case in that cultural context.
Exactly. The only logical reason the gospel writers included that detail is because they were stubbornly recording exactly what happened, regardless of how bad it looked for their PR.
That makes a ton of sense. And the second point connects to the honor culture of the ancient Mediterranean world, right?
Yes. The disciples initially doubted the resurrection when the women told them. Some of them hid. Thomas demanded to physically touch the wounds.
Yeah, doubting Thomas.
Right. In Jewish honor dynamics, looking like a cowardly, doubting fool was a massive cultural taboo. Yet, the Gospels portray the founding leaders of the church as exactly that. You do not invent an origin story that ruins your own reputation and paints you as the cowardly villain of your own movement.
Nobody writes themselves as the loser in a fake story.
Never. The third piece of evidence is the martyrdom test. The apostles had a proverbial gun to their heads. They were given the chance to recant, to admit they made it up, and save their own lives. Instead, they willingly died horrific deaths, crucified upside down, stoned, speared, rather than deny they saw Jesus resurrected.
Okay, let me push back on that, though. People die for cults all the time today. Look at Heaven's Gate or, you know, extremists who blow themselves up. They die for lies.
Yeah.
How is the apostles' martyrdom any different?
It's a great question. Modern cult members die for a lie they believe is true based on what someone else told them. The psychological mechanism with the apostles is fundamentally different.
How so?
They were in a position to know with absolute certainty whether the resurrection was a lie or not because they claimed to have physically eaten with and touched the resurrected Jesus. People might sacrifice themselves for a deeply held, misguided belief. But human psychology does not support a dozen distinct individuals willingly subjecting themselves to torture for a conspiracy they personally fabricated. You don't die for a lie you invented.
Wow, okay. That makes perfect sense. The final proof Kent brought up was Luke's investigation. The Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts are not, like, mystical poetry. They are literal investigative journalism.
Yes, very methodical.
Paul mentions in his letters that there were over 500 eyewitnesses to the resurrected Jesus. And he basically puts a footnote saying, hey, most of these people are still alive. Go ask them.
Yep.
Luke actually traveled around the Mediterranean interviewing these eyewitnesses to compile a factual, historical account for a Roman official.
He was daring his readers to fact-check his claims while the witnesses were still walking around. You just don't make a claim like that if you are inventing a legend decades later.
So what does this all mean for us? Kent brought the sermon home with a massive challenge, and this is the energy we need to carry into our Connect groups this week.
Definitely.
This is not an academic history lesson about ancient Roman execution methods or Jewish cultural norms. It is a life-altering reality. Kent stated that every single one of us, at the end of our lives, is going to face one single question. What did you do with Jesus?
It strips away every other metric we use to measure our lives. It doesn't matter how successful your business was, how much you accumulated in your bank account, or even how good of a parent you tried to be.
Right.
It ultimately comes down to a deeply personal invitation. Kent referenced Revelation 3:20, where the resurrected Jesus says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock."
And the beauty of that verse is what Jesus actually does when you open the door. He doesn't barge into your life with a clipboard and a massive list of rules to condemn you for everything you've done wrong.
No.
He doesn't come in to wipe you out like the flood, the text says. He comes in to eat with you. He brings a meal to dine with you. He brings his own blood to take the place of yours. It is an invitation to profound intimacy, not just a cold courtroom pardon.
And Kent illustrated the power of accepting that invitation by resolving his middle school story.
Oh, the gym class resolution.
Yeah. Years later, in high school, Kent had become a Christian. He was in the locker room, and a group of guys were bullying that exact same handicapped boy, whipping him with towels. Kent, who openly admitted he was naturally a coward who used to bully the boy himself, stepped right in between the bullies and the boy.
Wow.
He put his own physical safety on the line and told the bullies they had to go through him.
His life was fundamentally transformed. He wasn't relying on his own flawed willpower or a new set of rules to be a better person. He was changed from the inside out by accepting that elegant solution.
But Ken ended that story on a remarkably heartbreaking note. He mentioned that he is still friends with that man today, but because the man has a photographic memory, he remembers absolutely everything.
Everything.
He remembers Kent bravely standing up for him in the locker room, yes. Wait, no, he remembers the good stuff, but he also perfectly remembers the pain of Kent's past bullying from middle school.
Which leads to a profound final thought for us to ponder and debate in our Connect groups this week. Think about the nature of memory. If human memory, especially a photographic one, holds so tightly to the pain of the past, even after apologies are made, tears are shed, and lives are changed,
yeah.
How does the reality of Jesus completely becoming sin on the cross fundamentally rewrite how God remembers us?
That is so powerful. When God looks at us, he doesn't see the bullies we were, he doesn't see the lies we told or the corners we cut. He sees the perfect, elegant substitution. He sees the blood of the Lamb.
Contrast human memory with divine atonement this week. Talk about it in your Connect groups. What does it actually mean to live your daily life in a reality where the ultimate judge of the universe has rewritten his memory of your absolute worst moments?
It changes everything.
Because sometimes faith is not just about intellectually defeating this skeptical guy in the back of the bus. It is about being willing to look at the messy, muddy, regret-filled reality of our own lives, and realizing that the most elegant solution in the universe was there the whole time, just waiting for you to open the door.